Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to be talking with medical anthropologist Emily Mendenhall about her new book, Invisible Illness, A History from Hysteria to Long COVID. From lupus to Lyme, invisible illness is often dismissed by everyone but the sufferers. Why does the medical establishment continually insist that when symptoms are hard to explain, they're probably just in your head? Inspired by her work with long COVID patients, Emily Mendenhall traces the story of complex chronic conditions to show why both research and practice fail so many. Emily Mendenhall is professor in the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, a Guggenheim Fellow, and contributor to Scientific American, Psychology Today, and Vox. Emily Mendenhall, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a real privilege to chat with you today.
So I understand this book grew out of COVID, right? You started, talking with long COVID sufferers.
Yeah, I actually kind of think about this book as a bit longer than that. When I started working as an anthropologist, I was working at Cook County Hospital. And I started working with women who'd experienced extraordinary trauma and had diabetes. So for about 15 years, I was actually studying trauma and diabetes. So living with chronic illness while experiencing these social and psychological conditions in the US, in Kenya, in South Africa, and in India. And I think that work actually plays a significant role in how I think about long COVID and women's health more generally, and how women experience the healthcare system.
Let me back up. Tell me what a medical anthropologist is and does.
Well, medical anthropologists do a lot of different things. Generally, we think about how health is understood and experienced and embodied in relation to culture, politics, and society. And my particular interest has been how the world around us is embodied. So how it makes marks on the mind and the body. From trauma, such as experience with maybe violence as a child, or even microaggressions, or a financial stress, for example, that's chronic and maybe less visible but persistent, how all of these factors contribute to your health. And it may be, if we were thinking about these complex chronic conditions like long COVID, it may be that these insults over time multiply and compound and maybe interact with other viruses or pathogens, bacteria that become lodged in the body and then become inflamed. So, you know, really thinking about what chronic illness is and how people become sick and others do not, I feel and have studied for a long time that these extraordinary individual experiences nested within these larger politics and cultures are very important to understand that lived experience.
I'll skip ahead a little bit. I believe your belief is, and we can talk about this a little later, that long COVID presents an opportunity here, right? Because so many people suffer from long COVID, and maybe we can get some solutions out of this.
Yeah, let me back up a minute and let me tell you how I actually moved from studying long COVID particularly. During the pandemic, I was finishing the study on diabetes and chronic illness in South Africa, where I'd worked over a decade. And of course, we were all quarantined, and I was with my little family in DC with my, at the time, 4 and 6 year old, and my sister and brother-in-law and parents were in Iowa. So we, you know, put everyone in the car and drove out west to quarantine together. And my brother-in-law was leading the public health effort in this small town where I grew up, Okoboji, it's called. And when I arrived, we arrived in the middle of an outbreak. And being a very nosy anthropologist, as I am, I rolled up my sleeves and I was like, what is happening? Let me contribute, because my brother-in-law was leading the public health effort and was really unsure how to tackle this challenge. And, you know, in the DC area, everyone was masked and really careful. And out west, it was a very different story. And I'm sure in Utah, there were these differences of beliefs and complexities that played out as well. And I actually ended up writing a book called Unmasked, A History, or not a history, COVID Community and the Case of Okoboji, which is a loving reflection, but also critical reflection on what happened in my hometown. But during that time, as I was writing, I had a student who became incredibly sick with long COVID, and he was going to drop out of school, and we were working on an honors thesis, and he was going to drop it. And I said, well, why don't you just do an autoethnography, meaning why don't you just keep a very detailed diary of your lived experience, of your symptoms, your healthcare experiences, what you're thinking, what you're feeling. And so we did this for a year and a half. And as he started to feel better, He also interviewed clinicians and patients and others. And we ended up doing this like absolutely interesting and fascinating study. And a year after he got sick, I ended up getting COVID for the first time. And I don't identify as someone living with long COVID, although, you know, my theory of what happens and why long COVID presents in such different ways is it's kind of like a fire that becomes inflamed. And whatever complexities you come with, they become inflamed and exacerbated. And I have an anxiety disorder. So when I got long COVID, my anxiety went out of control, and I was really had a really hard time recentering. And I had fatigue for about 4 months. So that kind of, and I still actually, after I just had this infection about a month and a half ago, and I'm still not really back to normal. So that kind of experience of when I get sick, it takes me a lot longer to get back to what I see as my baseline. So those experiences combined with the wonderful support of the Guggenheim Foundation provided the space for me to do this work. I interviewed 150 people and went to all these conferences and engage and gave comments to the national academies on long COVID, and just had this extraordinary experience waving into this world, which also included interviewing policymakers and academics and people who had been thinking about the experience of complex chronic illness for a long time. And very quickly, I found out that although we were in this watershed moment of long COVID, where we'd had this global infectious disease that was very clearly linked to this chronic disabling condition, it was, this was not a news story. And as I started digging deeper and pulling back the layers, I just realized what an old story long COVID is.
What have you tell me about Bethany McCraw? The by the way, the stories and the people you talk to are just really hit you. That's, I guess that's the right, the lived experience here, right? Bethany McCraw, you opened the book with her. She got long COVID. She had already survived cancer. Right. Mm-hmm. Now she gets long COVID and just a horrible experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Bethany has been a great partner in this book. Actually, I don't even know how many times I interviewed her. We would just have consistent dialogue probably for about a year or more about her experiences. And I was actually put in touch with her from another person I'd interviewed, partly because I was really concerned about suicide. And people were, patients were increasingly talking about suicidal ideation because some of these people are really experiencing completely transformed social worlds and some despair because of it. And so I was connected with Bethany, and she was just absolutely generous with her time, but also fascinating and really just incredibly self-aware and educated about the psychophysiology as well as her experience, her social experience. And I just so enjoyed talking with her. It actually created a few just discussions with her and some other patients, people who are living with long COVID. And we had some dialogue about certain topics. And I've written a little bit about this on my blog, on my Substack, Long COVID and Anthropological Perspective. But that kind of dialogue was just really instructional for me and fascinating.
So Bethany, she almost loses her house, right? She gets to the point where she can't even function. Mm-hmm. Happily, she encounters a lawyer, helps her to get into, I guess, Medicaid and things. But she discovers a community, right? And that's a story that's repeated throughout the book. You have to, mm-hmm. medical communities, in large part, not helping you. You have to go and find a community.
Yeah, patient communities are an absolutely essential part of living with complex chronic illness. I think things have shifted. There's more acceptance now, but particularly at the beginning of the pandemic, people felt really marginalized in their communities, in their families, in medical settings. People didn't understand what they were going through and didn't really believe them. I call the book Invisible Illness, and it's in part because, you have these extraordinary feelings, dysautonomia, which is a common experience of people living with long COVID and other complex chronic illnesses like vertigo, fatigue, cognitive decline, all of these conditions or a racing heart. Are not visible. And living with that kind of disability can completely change your ability to work, to care for the people you love in your life, to do the things you enjoy, but they're not visible, like being in a wheelchair or having a physical difference in your body. So the struggle that people really faced was legitimacy. And that was something that is something that people can find in those communities online, which are absolutely essential.
I'm trying to find this in my notes here. I forget which person it is, but this person, and I'm forgetting the disease. I apologize to listeners, but she was told by her doctor, I think it was her doctor, that if you persist in this, if you keep pushing, you're going to be labeled a bad patient, right? Mm-hmm. And you're going to be diagnosed with this kind of this catch-all. Right.
Functional neurological disorder. I think you're talking about Lena. Yeah.
Lena. Thank you. You're going to get this diagnosis, which essentially equates to hysteria. Right. And you're going to kind of be blacklisted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this was a common experience. Multiple people said, you know, I learned through the online communities that I need to be very careful about how clinicians perceive me and what's written in my medical charts. And it's really important to also say that, you know, some patients will also identify doctors as bad doctors because clinicians are not trained often in medical school. It's like an afternoon when they talk about these kinds of complex chronic conditions. And in medical school, you're trained to have a specialty largely and to be able to be really good at fixing that and curing that problem. But with a complex chronic condition, it's multiple systems kind of become disentangled and malfunction at once. So it can be really difficult to identify and then diagnose a patient and get them the care that they need. And one of the challenges is most patients have more than one diagnosis, but they'll have a primary diagnosis. It might be long COVID. It might be an autoimmune disease. There's a Venn diagram of conditions that often cluster among people with these certain symptoms. And, you know, two people with the same primary diagnosis may look wildly different, while two people with two very different diagnoses might have similar overlapping conditions and look very similar. And this makes it very difficult to be a clinician caring for people because it's not clear. There's no verifiable test to say you're sick with what you think you're sick with or what it appears you're sick with, because that presentation may look very different in different people. And, you know, clinicians live within a structure especially in the for-profit system, where clinicians don't have enough time to speak with the patients who really need time and patience to speak through these issues. So, you know, patients feel rushed and dismissed, and clinicians feel frustrated and unsure. So this creates a real tension that I found was a real struggle for clinicians and patients alike.
I think sometimes we don't see it from the clinicians' point of view. This has to be totally frustrating, right? And then as you say, the system overlays itself, right? Geared toward more efficiency, right? Let's crank the patients through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when you're living with, I mean, it's easy if you go in and you take a blood test and you know what you're sick with, and there's a medicine that you can take that'll make you better. But, you know, not all health is about just fixing a biomarker, you know, a measure in your blood or just dealing with a symptom. There might be really more complex, rooted systemic issues. And I use the concept of thresholds in the book Invisible Illness. And I use that to talk about the complexities in which people's illness flares. So we make, you know, I talked about this a little bit earlier, but you may carry different traumas from your life. You may have in certain organs, even different microbiomes. So you may have a certain collection of pathogens in your gut or on your liver. And this can cause different kinds of dysfunction and different kinds of malfunction in different organs, even within your body. And someone who's done a lot of incredible work on this is Mike Van Elziger and Amy Prowell at the PolyBio Research Center in Boston. They've done a lot of incredible, physical research, biological research on how these conditions trigger or how people's bodies start to unravel and what this means. So that it's actually quite an optimistic thing to understand that there may be a trigger that starts an unraveling, because it also indicates that there may be a maybe gentle, slow way of building resilience again. But it's not a quick fix, which makes it more difficult for medicine to treat.
So you say this book is as much about health as it is about illness. Tell me about that.
Well, how we conceptualize health as a healthy person, a healthy worker, a healthy parent, a healthy friend, what it looks like, how you present may be very different than how you feel. Illness is, as in the among medical anthropologists, we would say illness is a lived experience. You may be diagnosed, like we said, you could be diagnosed with the same thing. Let's say you and I both have diabetes. But maybe I have a number of other things and you have a number of other things or different social experiences. I have two young children and, you know, I'm a working mom. So my challenges, and I don't know your lived experience, but because of our unique positionality in society and the different things we carry, our living with illness may be very different. For example, if you have access to reliable, high quality medical care, and have a high paying or secure job, you're going to have a really different experience than someone who maybe doesn't have medical care and can't seek medical care or have the time to go to all of the specialists that are currently required if you're diagnosed with a condition like long COVID. Currently, even if you're lucky enough to live near a long COVID clinic, what they are switchboards. It's not like you go into this room where they try to intensely diagnose you. You are actually connected with several different clinicians and follow-up specialists, which is really hard if you have an exhaustive condition or dysautonomia. So some people actually have a difficult time getting up to take a shower or walk up and down the stairs. So, attending that many clinical visits, especially when you're on an odyssey to figure out what's wrong with you, can be really harmful and difficult.
This is a little bit later in the book, a woman named Tam. It had problems from childhood, right? And just a quote from the book, Tam's pelvic area, lower back were cramping and pain so intense. Felt like someone was stabbing her repeatedly. She'd get dizzy, nauseated when she tried to stand, throw up, double over. And she describes the medical gaze of clinicians who didn't take her pain seriously. This, I guess, she describes as a medical gaze. First of all, tell me about her. I guess this is kind of typical, her interaction with the medical profession. Then I want to talk about kind of the end of the story, which is more positive now. But her interaction, how did she finally get help?
Well, the medical gaze is actually a quote, and then there's an endnote that links it to a book called The Medical Gaze by Greenlaw. Ah. So it's a great book that actually is a memoir of living with chronic pain. But I thought actually Tam's story embodied that experience quite tremendously, in part because her primary diagnosis, at least at the beginning, was endometriosis. And I think endometriosis is a really interesting, tricky condition that women face because for so long it was misunderstood. And even today, patients will take 6 to 8 years to get diagnosed with it. And what it is something that's very hard to find and to identify, and the pain can be incredibly hard. So we talk about endometriosis as people who have really high pain thresholds because they've endured so much pain, but it's hard to verify. It's hard to find. It's also really complicated to treat. So because of that, I think endometriosis is a really interesting case study. And it can cause a spiraling or a cascade of certain conditions because for so long you don't have treatment, or clinicians may treat you for something else because they're trying to figure out how to get you well. But that could, of course, spiral into other things. At one point, Tam had to take a steroid because of her pain and she gained 70 pounds on the steroid. We know steroids cause weight gain, which caused all these other health issues. And it's also very interesting that at one point, Tam never thought she could be pregnant, but she does get pregnant at some point. And then during the 3 years she was breastfeeding, she had no pain. So, it's really interesting how the body responds and how our hormones through the life can be protective in certain ways. And, women's hormones and women's changes, particularly in mid and late life, are quite understudied. And it's an area that, really could use more context. And I think the living with complex chronic conditions provides a window into doing that research.
I want to just quote this a little bit from your book. We're talking with Emily Mendenhall, Invisible Illness is the book. Tam moves to Ireland, and she's cultivated a new normal, you say. She continues to manage health disruptions through medication, regulation of emotions, social relations, environment. She's built a dynamic community of friends and feels she has some control over her health. So, you know, she isn't totally free from the problem, but she has this new normal.
Yeah, and it's actually, these kinds of conditions are so unpredictable. Actually, after this book went to press, she was on vacation and had a severe problem. I don't remember exactly what, it was something that put her in the hospital, and then she got 3 infections and couldn't come home for 2 months. So her story, it sounds like it's all tidied up and clean at the end, but it actually continues to persist and be complicated. And she is extraordinary, honestly. I've been encouraging her to set up a blog because she does write quite a bit, for her community. But she is, you know, hopefully going to more extensively document her own story. And I've been helping her do that a little bit. But, you know, it's an extraordinary experience that she's gone through.
Let's take a brief break. We're talking with Emily Mendenhall, who's a medical anthropologist. The new book is available. It's called Invisible Illness, A History from Hysteria to Long COVID. And we'll have more following this brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with medical anthropologist Emily Mendenhall. A fascinating new book is called Invisible Illness, A History from Hysteria to Long COVID. From lupus to Lyme, invisible illness is often dismissed by everyone but the sufferers. And Emily Mendenhall asked, why does the medical establishment continue to insist that when symptoms are hard to explain, they're probably just in your head? So we're talking about, obviously, long COVID, endometriosis we've talked about. What are some of the other, I think we kind of vaguely know some of these chronic illnesses that are so hard to diagnose and that people suffer with?
Yeah, there's 2 others in the first part of the book that's more about the historical foundation of thinking about these illnesses. Is one is complex, the chronic fatigue syndrome or myalgic encephalomyelitis, ME-CFS, which it's often called. And, you know, the first chapter of the book is on hysteria, and I talk about the hysteria and neurasthenia, these 2 more historic terms that have been largely used to explain women's suffering or dismiss women's suffering. But the chronic fatigue syndrome is a really interesting case study because it really is an American-made diagnosis and condition, which is quite dismissive to the complexities that women experience. And I tell the story of how that illness came to be. And it is so fascinating to think about chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME-CFS as it's often called, because a lot of the recognition that it was starting to get in the patient community that was starting to organize was in the early 1980s. And I even had an interview. I wrote a piece on my interview with Tony Fauci in Scientific American, because even he said, you know, I'm really interested in autoimmune diseases, which is something that he has studied. But, you know, when I was starting to study infection-associated conditions, but at the same time, AIDS took over our conscience and the medical community's urgency in the 1980s. Excuse me. And what was so interesting at that time was, and I've written a little bit about this, and Emily Lim Rogers, a brilliant medical anthropologist who's written about AIDS activism and chronic fatigue syndrome, argued that the political activism of HIV and AIDS have been, you know, transformative for how people and patients organize and advocate for care. But what that did at the time is, you know, people who had AIDS could organize and protest until they couldn't, until they died. But people living with chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME-CFS, became quite sick and ill. And 1 in 4 people living with this condition are bedbound. So they were so ill, they couldn't protest, and they didn't die. So they lived a very long time. And one of the things that has emerged from that, and I think the long COVID community, it has been exceptional. And the activists in the long COVID community by some have been compared to Larry Kramer, who was an early AIDS activist in the 1980s, who actually recently died only a few years ago. And they've compared him as in their innovation and their ability to mobilize. And one of the things that has happened from the ME-CFS community, the chronic Lyme community, which is another condition I discuss in the book, and now the long COVID community, is they have transformed visibility of these patients through digital activism. Also, these online patient communities, like you mentioned, you know, doctors are pretty wary of online communities because it's, you know, they have a different kind of way of speaking and thinking, and communicating about their illness, which is, you know, pretty different than medical talk. And so it causes some misalignment of conversation. But the ways in which they've been able to organize and advocacy and advocate and get recognition for money, for research, for care has been pretty transformative and quite rapid.
What is needed? What are these activists most asking for? What do you think an outline of a solution would be?
I think it's pretty multifaceted. There's a lot of needs. One of the primary needs early on was recognition. So recognizing what long COVID was and how people suffered from it and what they needed. What do people need? They need someone to care for them. They need a house to stay in. They need recognition that they're sick. So that's very different if you have a family who has financial resources and can care for you. Or, you know, a lot of people like Bethany almost lost her home, but I spoke to a lot of people who are homeless. One woman I interviewed lived in a tent for 2 years in a national park or a state park because she lost her house. And her friend who was in a tent next to her, in fact, died because he couldn't afford his heart medication. So these are real experiences that are happening to American citizens because our healthcare system is broken and we don't have a safety net that can care for people who are really suffering. And that is a huge challenge. So understanding how we can care for people who are very, very ill, so much so that they you know, lose their home and their livelihoods or maybe their lives, is incredibly important. Also, a lot of activists have called for more research. One of the biggest challenges for many patients living with conditions like long COVID is verifiability, because there's not a test that you can take that says you are sick with what you think you're sick with. And because of that, people are dismissed and misunderstood generally, not only in medicine, but by families, by society. So, you know, many patients call for more research to understand exactly, is there a way to reverse this condition? Is there a way that can treat this condition that is effective? So that's a huge priority.
You use the term, I think it's body mind. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that. Why do you use that term?
Well, I use that term thoughtfully. The disability justice community uses that term quite thoughtfully, because it is a term, and I have a colleague, Amy Kenny, who I talk about in the book, who corrected me multiple times when I started this book, because I hadn't really been engaged with the disability justice literature or movement or activists extensively before. A lot of my work has been internationally in Kenya, South Africa, India, as well as US. But Amy was using the word body mind, and she had me read. I mean, she's like, okay, well, you have to do this reading, this reading, this reading. And I started reading about how disability activists talk about illness in a way that is, I think, more profound than any other area in our society. Because I mean, I've always known, and in my research, especially on the psychophysiology of diabetes, meaning how diabetes moves through the mind and body and society, and what it looks like. Through that work, it was very clear that, you know, stress from your social life mental distress is also deeply interrelated and bidirectional with diabetes or bodily distress. So body mind is a term that begs for understanding that the mind and body are not separate things. The mind is of the body, and they are bound.
There's an interesting section here in your chapter on Lyme disease. The subheadline is "Illnesses You Fight to Get," and I want to read this. This is very distinctive. You write that in her Lyme disease memoir, Invisible Kingdom, writer Megan O'Rourke recalls, and you quote Megan O'Rourke, "In the middle of the night when I woke in the dark with my heart pounding, what really terrified me was the conviction that my doctors did not believe me. So I would never have partners in my search for answers and treatments. How could I get better if no one thought I was sick?" That's the insidiousness of the invisible part of this, right?
Yeah, that's an essential part that was extraordinary thread throughout the interviews I conducted with patients, people who were diagnosed or some had not been diagnosed or had to fight to get a diagnosis. It's so common. People would discuss their diagnostic odysseys, which would mean they would go to one clinician and be dismissed. They go to another clinician, or they'd go to a non-medical healthcare provider, and they'd look for answers. And you know, some people would send off their own blood specimens to certain labs that were doing tests because their doctors wouldn't do those tests just to find some answers. Chronic Lyme is really interesting case study. There are some labs that can test for chronic Lyme and can verify it, although they're very expensive and it's hard to get a clinician to even send your specimens there. And some, I think actually, I interviewed Abigail Dumas, and Abby Dumas wrote a book called Divided Bodies, which is a beautiful book on chronic Lyme, and I'll never do it justice. Her book is so thoughtful and deep, so everyone should read it if you're interested in this topic. But the complexities of dissonance about what chronic Lyme is and how it should be treated are so deep and wide that many clinicians won't even diagnose you with chronic Lyme because of the fear that they'll lose their medical license. So there are two different camps defining what Lyme disease is, what chronic Lyme disease is, and how it should be treated. So there's two sets of guidelines. Some guidelines by a group that practices conventional medicine, and a group that they call is Lyme literate, and has a different collection of definitions. And I think it shows how the issue of verifiability and how one should be cared for can be so divisive and disruptive in the medical establishment itself. And really understanding why and how these divisions occur really matter. And the conventional diagnostic is actually very more widely accepted by insurance companies. And there's a very clear set of infusions and treatments that can be followed, and then that's it. And then Lyme literate clinicians have a very different strategy. And it's because of, I think, payment in our for-profit medical system that makes these divisions so stark and so challenging.
Molly's story is very interesting. You know, so many interesting stories, but I want to talk about Molly. In the end, she discovered she has Lyme disease, but she didn't know at the time. I just want to quote this. The diagnostic uncertainty around Molly's condition unsettled her clinicians. One suggested that possibly her chronic migraines, fatigue, and muscle aches were linked to having four children under the age of four at home, and which is, I'm laughing, but it's kind of a sad laugh here, illustrating what you could call misogyny, right? This is common, you write, in medicine, where women's fatigue, infections, autoimmune conditions are perceived by clinicians as hysteria or feminine malaise.
Yeah, this is a common story among many people I interviewed. And, you know, it's not just gender, but, you know, racism inflames how people understand health even more profoundly. So many Black women, including Black professional women, even some Black women who are doctors themselves, who said, you know, no one will believe my pain. And, you know, in a country where, you know, maternal mortality among Black Americans is extraordinary and much higher than other racial ethnic groups. We can understand how this kind of plays out in people's medical experiences. But the role of sexism was just profound.
So continuing the story of Molly, she didn't return to the conversation about testing for chronic Lyme disease with her new doctor until her pain was so bad she couldn't walk or move her arms. Her husband basically had to do everything for her at that point. And I guess in just the distress, she said, hey, test me for Lyme disease, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, she'd been told again and again that it wasn't a real condition and that it wasn't worth testing for. And slowly people had started talking about it with her. Hey, maybe you do have Lyme disease. And when you're that desperate, you really want to do anything possible to peel back the onion. It's like one neuroscientist I spoke to said that long COVID or chronic Lyme or a complex chronic condition like this is like peeling back the layers of an onion, trying to figure out which layer will tell you some sort of truth or validate your pain in a certain way. So finally she was like, let's just test for this thing that people, you know, that some say it might be and others don't think it's real, but let's do it. Because I need to find out whatever is going on. I need to understand why I'm so sick. And so that's when she sent off her test.
So to pause here, and so overall, you talk to many, many people, including, you know, on one side, the patients, and on the other side, the doctors. So starting with patients, with people who are suffering from these chronic illnesses, where did they in general find success in navigating the medical establishment? Because this could be so confusing, so maddening, so frustrating, costly, right? Where are those lines of success, do you think?
You know, I think everyone has a really different story, and I think that's really interesting and something to understand. And in some cases, people found success in conventional medicine. I have a clinician, Rachel Hall Clifford, who is a brilliant anthropologist at Emory, and she got quite sick, and her husband's a clinician, and she was able to go to this all-women team that did work on chronic conditions, and they were able to take her seriously, and they appreciated her own research and understanding of the illness. And she did quite well with them. She still, I think, suffers from time to time, but she had wonderful care. Now, on the other hand, there's many people who, you know, maybe never find someone who can support them in the way that they need, or they bounce around from clinician to clinician. Others find that functional medicine doctors who often try to focus on getting to the root of what's going on. So they may do many, many, many tests to figure out what is the root of someone's suffering, which can be kind of difficult, especially when you are experiencing a threshold. So I argue in the book that people experience thresholds. So long COVID, for example, or chronic Lyme might be something that tips you over into dysregulation. So you might have multiple things going on, but that infection is what makes you quite sick. Another type of kind of clinician or clinical care that people seek is from integrated medicine, which of course is different than functional medicine, is different than conventional medicine, but is much more integrative, trying to think about well-being in the whole body and the multiple social and environmental issues that might also be at play at the body-mind. So these are three different kinds of medical care, but you know, a lot of people seek care from acupuncture, massage, different types of medical care, from heat strategies to, you know, nutritional strategies. And people have different wellness journeys. Some people have different kinds of medication, or, you know, there's some people that get from ME/CFS or have dysautonomia because they have spinal, they have fluid in their spine. And one effective strategy for people with pretty intense spinal fluid is to drain it, and then some of their symptoms go away. You know, so every case is so different, and that's what makes it so difficult to diagnose and treat.
You, in the book, you argue for transformation of healthcare system. You say, by recognizing the experiences of complex patients as legitimate sources of knowledge, the medical establishment, you know, science in general, has one way of looking at things, how we establish a body of knowledge. You're saying that experiences of these patients should be legitimate sources of knowledge. Tell me about that.
I think this comes back to a different power dynamic that we haven't really discussed, which is authority in medicine. And when you go to medical school, you go to a lot of school. You spend years in school, you spend years in residency, you spend a lot of money. And through that, you know, I would call medicine a culture in itself. So through that enculturation to become a doctor and to think like a doctor and to care like a doctor in this system, you are trained to hold a great amount of authority. And so when a patient comes into you and is speaking a different language about their illness, maybe not the same medical terms, or using language that they may have with their patient community or they've read about in journals, there's often a bit of a conflation or a conflict between the clinician and patient in what is valid knowledge and how one can get better. And that came up again and again and again. And you know, this is not a new problem. AIDS activists in the early 1980s and late 1980s and 1990s, especially with ACT UP and other activist organizations, would write out on papers specifically how you address your doctor and how you can slowly maneuver through a medical appointment and be taken seriously. So this is not a new problem. This is something that people have had to shape for years. And I mean, Tam is a great example of a patient who has a very complicated history. And her, no one is going to have her case. There's not a, you're not going to really study her case in a medical textbook. So she's the, you know, greatest holder of knowledge of understanding. And when you have a weird condition that no one can diagnose, you're obviously going to study up on every symptom and conditions that you can based on the information you have access to. So understanding that when you can, when a clinician confronts a patient living with this kind of complexity, is just extraordinarily crucial.
One more thing on the side of the you know, the researchers and the doctors, you say, and I think it's pretty obvious, biomedicine has a struggle, or they struggle with ambiguity. How does training of doctors need to change? What needs to change so that the, so the medicine can deal with ambiguity a little better?
I mean, that's a really good question. I personally do think medicine needs to change, and some programs are changing. Some programs are focused differently, focused more on the biopsychosocial model and that kind of training. There are, in my view, and I argue this at the end of the book, in my view, there needs to be a real reckoning about this complexity, and even maybe a residency in complex chronic conditions. But even having that training in complex chronic conditions and really recognizing and being able to work with and care for patients living with these conditions that are unverifiable and not quick fixes is difficult in a medical system that doesn't create the space for this care or pay for this care. So if you think about the VA or military medicine, if you go into the VA is going to create this kind of comprehensive care experience that you need, because profit isn't at the center of this care. It's really about caring for veterans. So you may have a primary doctor that's doing tests. You may have a rheumatologist run down. You might have an infectious disease doctor run over. And, you know, they might all work together and communicate about your case to get to the origin of your distress, or at least to help you alleviate your symptoms and provide one or two diagnoses to explain your suffering. And just receiving a diagnosis can be transformative for people, especially when you're, you know, seeking the challenge or, you know, trying to understand what's wrong with you for so long. But in for-profit medicine, or especially if you're relying on Medicaid, or if you don't have insurance, a lot of people right now who have depended on the Affordable Care Act are losing health insurance because of the changes that are happening currently. And I did research in Chicago with Mexican immigrants seeking care before the Affordable Care Act. And what I argued in my first book, Endemic Suffering, is that people are falling through the cracks simply because they're working 60 hours a week, but they don't have jobs that provide secure medical care. So despite working overtime, they don't have any security. And by living and falling through the cracks in that way, there's just no way to get reliable medical care, especially when you have this kind of condition. And a lot of the work on these conditions have focused on middle class or upper middle class white women. But they are obviously not the only people who experience these conditions, and people's different kind of layered social identities create accessing care more difficult.
Just have a couple minutes left. What's the top takeaway you would have listeners take away from the book, from this discussion?
Well, I mean, personally, I think we need to reimagine medical care, but I think that is gets to the heart of what is wrong with the system in general. And I would argue wholeheartedly that health is a social good. It's something we need to invest in as a people. We need to care for mothers. We need to care for children. We need to care for fathers. We need to care for workers. We need to care for, you know, everyone in our lives. And in that way, how the health systems need to be reorganized and reimagined need to be not profit oriented. And that runs up against the American ethos of health. I mean, I often talk about this with my students, that if there had been, public education and public health or public or hospitals were oriented in the same way when the United States was imagined, we may have a completely different health system today. But our history of medicine has created this system where we need to have a reckoning and reimagine how healthcare can be provided for people, specifically the most vulnerable, who are struggling with conditions that are unverified and become invisible.
We've been talking on Access Utah with medical anthropologist Emily Mendenhall. Her new book is out and available now, Invisible Illness, A History from Hysteria to Long COVID. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for the discussion.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be here.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.